You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
And we're back. Hey, everyone. Tamara here, your host, for another day of Inside Launch Street. All right, this is part two of the strategy deep dive, where we go over those two books, Good Strategy, Bad Strategy, and Rocket Fuel. And we being me and my colleague, Derek, who's also geeks out over all this stuff, where we deconstruct strategy and we get into the case study. So this is part two. If you haven't listened to part one, I highly recommend that you go back and do that. Part two is where we get into the real world case study. So we kind of go through Derek's business and then we go through mine. And you'll see, as I got into this podcast, I started to realize that I had some flaws in my thinking and that I wasn't doing strategy right. And I was buying into the myths and some of the kind of just old ways of doing things. So Derek and I actually pull it apart and come up with a better way to do my strategy, which I am super psyched about and has already made a difference. And I think it's going to make a difference for you as well as you think about your objectives and where you're headed and how to kind of rethink goal setting and the things that really are supposed to drive us forward. Okay, enough said. Here we go.
Have you ever read the book, The One Thing?
Yes, by Kelly, the guy who started, was it Keller Williams?
William Keller, but I can't remember which one.
Yeah, I think Keller made it.
My post-production team will find the book and like put the link. Yeah. Here's the thing I love about that, and I think this applies to the diagnosis as much as it does the strategy. Right? His whole thing was, what's the one thing that by doing that makes all of the things easier, more relevant, whatever, right? And I love that. And I try to do that every morning. But I think that's true in the key issues, is what are the key issues that if I address these, all other things kind of fall under it.
Right, exactly.
Because I think sometimes we have the challenge of almost having too many key issues, right?
That's
where everything becomes a key issue and then you can't diagnose anything because it's all there.
Right. And the one thing approach forces that distillation to the top key issue.
Right.
And then addresses that in the next part of strategy, right? So, and that is a good methodology. I think that even if it's more than one thing, that process is very effective.
Right.
Sure.
And it just reminded me, like, when I think about those things, there's a million other things we could talk about with key issues in diagnosis, but those are the things that if you deal with that, everything else falls under it in some way.
That's right. And another useful, you just reminded me of something, one of my mentors, Marshall Thurber, he had this concept of the trim tab, which he got from Buckminster Fuller, who's a futurist. Have you heard of the trim tab?
Oh.
Do you know what that? So a trim tab is, on these giant ocean liners, they have the rudder, right? It's huge. And to move that rudder against that pressure is impossible. So what they have, there's a thin strip on the back of the rudder, and it's called the trim tab. And when that, it flips, creates a little bit of space, which allows it to move. So how does that relate? Trying to identify the trim tab in your business. What are the highest impact things that can propel you to your objective the best way.
Right.
And that's both in the key issues, but then in the next thing we'll talk about, which in the book, you're going to have to tell me, because you're innovative, incredibly innovative. Oh, that's your whole thing, right? That's fun. Bringing innovation to the entire world.
Yes, to the universe.
Yes. Well, I mean, what I know about technology, innovation is a necessity.
Yes.
Not something that's nice to have.
Agreed.
You will not survive in the world that we have now and where we're going without it.
So true.
So the next part, he calls this operating policy. And this is where I hate that term. So we call it principled methodology.
Uh-huh.
I don't even like that. What are the core concepts that we're going to develop action plans from, but are independent from those action plans that address all of the key issues from the diagnosis. So we have these four or five things, and so we need a plan for that. So our focus points, and again, these things are broader but still specific enough. They aren't action items. They are approaches or methodologies that you can use as guiding lights in informing your ongoing action plan. So, and they are always specific, again, to the diagnosis. So the operating policy or principle methodology, in our cases, there's two of them. The first is we focus on delivering transformational client experiences. And why that is, clients, we need to dispel the dynamic marketplace, the confusion, the fear, all of those things. And so, and also we have to overcome techie and non-techie dialogue. So as part of what we do, we of course have to execute against the best technology we have out there, but the clients have to experience it in such a way where they understand what's happening and that the results are clear. And that the only way to deliver a transformative client experience is if we understand them. So it is inherent that we need to do a good strategy, understand them, understand their business, and then understand technology, and then assemble a priority. So our overarching principle is to deliver transformational client experience. The other thing we have in place is this company is about growing superhumans, our extraordinary humans. So our internal focus that meets this on the other side is when we have very principled ways of approaching things that my team learns how to handle stress. We focus deliberately on communication. We focus on a structure of things that we know are going to grow them as humans and better serve the clients, because technology is hard. It burns people out all the time. And we can't have to be great at Google Ads and not understand how to communicate and work with clients. So by choosing to focus on a deliberate structured program to grow them as peoples and how they work as a team, which many actions flow from, but that is a core approach that addresses the other side of the client, which our team is growing to match what we saw as market opportunity for us.
So let me put this into a progression for a second so that we can all see how good strategy makes a massive difference.
Right.
The key issues, right, are hammer, dynamic change, confusion and disconnect, black magic,
right,
systematizing the approach.
Right.
The strategy based on that diagnosis, on those key issues, is, and I might change a little bit, I might say transformative employee and client experience.
Right. Perfect. Right? That's great.
I think that's actually because you wrote what you just said.
Right.
So, okay, so key issues, strategy, transformative client and employee experiences.
You got it, right.
That translates to client relationships and how you do it, right? You're that part of the business. It translates to how you think about adaptive strategy, building strategy for your clients.
Exactly.
It translates to how you communicate we've had those conversations about like dashboards and reporting to your clients.
Right.
It also impacts how you think about making sure you get results, because it can't be transformative if you're not blowing their minds.
It has to, right,
on the results, right? So.
Delivering insights instead of data, right?
Right.
Reporting is almost a dirty word, but what we need to do is deliver the insights.
Reporting is a tool to get to insights.
That's
it's
exactly
not the
right.
final.
That's right.
That's my big, we've had discussions about this. Like, I really get frustrated because I think people tend to deliver information.
Right.
I don't need you to give me the information. I can read that.
Yep.
What I want to do is have a conversation about the insights, which is what the information tells you or can tell you.
Right.
But again, just to break it out from a flow perspective, it's like diagnosis, strategy, and then tactics, right?
Exactly. A coherent action plan, right? And so those big principles about transformation of client experience, and then for employees and clients.
Yeah, I'm going to write that down on the board while you're talking.
So from that principle, we then inform a coherent action plan, and that plan, as the world, the client's business changes, technology is changing, we circle back to that principle before we develop action plans. And every month, we are checking in and evaluating, are we on point for that globally? And we do that by individual client as well.
So that leads to the next section, right, which is really proximate objectives.
Right.
Right? So let's talk a little bit about that, because that comes directly out of good strategy, bad strategy. And
right.
I think it's a fundamental shift in how we think about quote unquote goal setting,
right,
which I hate.
Oh, I hate the word
right.
goal setting.
I know, too. Well, there's so many issues with it. Like, issue one is when you get there, then what?
Right.
You're done? Like, what the hell? And second, what does that goal really mean? Where did that number come from, or that whatever it is come from? And what are you supposed to do to get there? So that's my issue with it. Proximate objectives are really more about helping you understand where you are relative to your overall strategy, right? Like, it should, what you get out of that should help inform where you're headed next, the decisions you make. So what are your proximate objectives? What are some that would help you know, am I achieving against our strategy in those different departments?
Right. So, so proximate objectives, there's a couple. One is, you know, when we talk about how do we measure client experience, we have a different policy and approach here than most of the other people. They want to jump into high techy solutions, et cetera, et cetera. So how we do it as a check for understanding and reporting is what it is commonly called, but we have these collaborative sessions and proximate objectives would be written strategy for each client, pulling out the key metrics and communicating them into a way that is structured and reliable. And we are ensuring that we are delivering that experience. We check for understanding. There's a variety of ways to do it where we are, the client has to answer back to us. It's not like we torture our clients. We ensure though that they are understanding both progress and results, that we are then absorbing their, so we have a checklist of items. So approximate objective for us is continue to refine how we're delivering it and then checking back with the clients to make sure it's on point.
So basically it's like your approximate objectives are delivering insightful reporting at every client interaction.
Right.
And a client feedback of positive. And it's not a matter of it 1 through 10 or however but point being that like the client is happy and you know the client's happy because they understand what you're doing and they're happy with the progress, which means you're delivering transformative experience.
You got it.
Right? Relative. Yeah. So, but again, the key to that, in my opinion, coming from the book directly, is it's an indicator of what to do.
Right.
So for example, this is not what's happening, but for example, if you found that like you were getting emails from clients that were like, hey, like we're not getting what we need, you would know that you're not mapping against.
Exactly.
Against a transformative experience.
Yep. And you know, other proximate objectives that I find, like a typical one would be, well, reach this much X in monthly revenue, right? We target more around right size fit. So approximate objective is so we continue to ensure, are we delivering the value for the investment and making that clear? And that is not something that is static and easy to do. So we will set them specifically for clients within each engagement so that the client sees the proximate objective.
Right. So then your objective for Brility as a company is that you're meeting your client objectives.
That's right. Exactly. Right. And how we
so interesting.
Right. And how we we get a lot of practice. I mean, you know, the final piece on proximate objective is a way to clarify a coherent action plan once you understand what you're up against and you understand your concepts to address those.
Right.
But in our world, we have an additional feedback mechanism that can feed the strategy, can pull out new key issues, which are that idea of in digital, everything's tracked, privacy's dead, right? So everywhere you go tomorrow, they know.
I swear to God, sometimes I get ads for something I thought about. And I'm like,
or send someone else, or everyone's listening. Hail Lord Google.
Totally.
So
that happened to me and a friend the other day. We were having a discussion about, in my kitchen, about a certain protein powder that we both sent, that we both love. And I swear, she sends me a picture the next day in her Facebook feed of a scent, and I got it too. We were like, no way. And I'm sure it's because we follow all the CrossFit memes too. So like, I'm sure there's other reasons, but both of us were like, what?
Yeah, there is a bias. I researched that. And yes, they do listen, number one. Yeah. Two.
But we also follow the feeds.
Right. Well, we have a bias with what did Daniel Kahneman say? What you're thinking about right now is not as important as you think it is.
Right.
And because we have this unfair, focus on what is immediate, and it gets overweight. So that raises our attention. You talk about the RIS, that raises our attention to it. So we'll see things we already saw and think it's magic.
Well, 90% of our thoughts are roughly are repetitive
in any given day.
So you're just thinking what you thought yesterday.
That's what everyone but me.
Right. Mine's flipped, of course.
Yeah, but my favorite is 82% of American drivers think they're better than average.
Which is not how I feel on the road. I'm like, I'm a 1% who's a decent driver.
Right.
Okay, so just going back to this. So
the idea is on the final part of why in the digital arena, strategies and action plans both can adapt is we have immediate feedback. The challenge is data is everywhere. So there's always built into everything we do a process to pull the key insights out that then inform either we could identify key issues like you started to not rank for your name anymore. Competition's moving in. They didn't when we started, they are now. And also, like, is this working? Is this not working? Where's the highest return on your money? So you get this rapidly evolving action plan based on immediate feedback. But all of that is informed by principled thinking because you figured out what's key in the market.
So how would you know if you are not living up to how would you know if your strategy is or isn't working of transformative employee and client experiences? Let's hone in on that for a second.
Right. So, I mean, there's multiple ways to look at it. You know, you can look at client. So there are longer term evaluations. So what are the key metrics that we use to judge that? Ensuring that there's a written strategy and that we are delivering understanding to the client. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we said it's now part of our operating system. That's how we operate.
Right.
So, you know, our longest client is 10 years and they existed. They followed me from company to company. Also number of, fans, how many of our clients refer other clients? Mm. So,
that's a great one.
Within those, we have some key issues. You know, most of our clients, two-thirds actually ask us to increase the agreement.
That's another indicator.
That's another one. And then we will check with them to say, you know, we don't want to over-educate. We don't want to inundate you, but we check and say, do you understand the market dynamics enough now so that you feel we can collaborate successfully? If we don't pull out the marketing manager or the business owner or the VPs, if we don't give enough common ground to share, so we measure and track how much they are sharing with us and then how impactful that is later. So, and obviously we have hard metrics in there, like how much growth, organic traffic, how much, ultimately we try to distill to how much business did we generate for them and do we track it? And we want at least a 2x return out of the gates, up to 15x. So those are more measurable, but the harder part is, are they understanding both progress and those results? So the easiest ones are the ones that we can pull data and show comparative. And we always show, don't tell, because that's how the primal mind thinks. So it's a lot of how we measure success. Some of them are slightly intangible. Most of them are hard data, but you know, not everything that matters is measurable. And that was, I think Deming said that. So we have to, there's a little bit of, you know, how the client engages with us and how they explain us to others.
So I love that, because what you're saying is like the things that you're tracking are like referral, if they increase the project, not because of the dollar amount, but because that tells you you're doing good work and they want more.
That's right.
Right? And are those communication experiences, and that's the part that's hard to track, are you guys collaborating in a real way? Because that tells you if they understand and if you're explaining accurately, right? Not kind of taking away the black magic.
That's right.
So again, for all of us, what I really appreciate about what we're talking about, we're about to dig into Launch Street. And I feel like I have some work to do on the strategy, so I'm happy to tear it apart. We even tore it apart a little bit before we started recording. So that's not why we didn't record it. But hopefully we can all see how the fundamental starting point, right, is the diagnosis. And that diagnosis is so missed in most strategies. And not only in most strategies, but in most books about strategy. Right. That's the part that drives me nuts. It's like, and so when I read Good Strategy Mastery, I was like, oh my God, this is the piece that I've been missing all along, was a proper diagnosis of the situation. Yeah. So
and just to elaborate on that, most books are, here's the checklist of what works here. And unless you properly understand the situation you're in, that checklist, some of it may work, some of it may not, but it is like blindly slapping on, this worked for these guys, here's what it is. So without that piece, the best pre-assembled strategy is a dangerous move. It is not as effective as one that is actually tailored based on understanding to the current dynamics, not trends, Tamara. Right?
I think
you're right. That's a big distinction.
I just think that we spend too much time trying to add certainty long-term to a place where we don't have it.
Right, exactly. And trend, you know, is as commonly used, is actually exactly the wrong thing.
Right.
It is market dynamics.
Right.
You can probably see.
Okay. Right. So let's go to Launch Street. And like I said, I feel like there's some work to it. And I want to back up and sit and talk a little bit about the conversation we had around purpose first and kind of how we changed that. So I put together a document that is a kind of our strategy document, right? It's kind of our one page front and back around who we are as a company, what we believe in, what we deliver. I wanted that first so that I could get to the strategy, but I wanted to make sure we understood our values and all that, because I think that should impact your strategy too. 100%. That's the DNA of your company or how you operate as a human if you're not, like if you're a one-man team.
Right.
And one of the things that you made me realize, because this goes to, I think, in how we think about goals, is I put down our driving purposes, unleash 1 million everyday innovators into the world. And that excites me, right? Because right. It's like, oh my God, think about the problems we could solve, the opportunities right. we create, the satisfaction we'd all feel if 1 million of us just embrace that part of us. And you push back on me, right? So to talk a little bit about that, because I think I'm just going to be raw and real. I'm like, I'm going to share all the crap so everybody can see.
Yeah. So the driving purpose for me is something that is it's highly emotive, and it is something that is principled in thinking that can carry you forward. It isn't a specific measurable outcome.
It's not a number.
It's not a number, right?
Right.
Because
what happens when you reach it?
Right,
so exactly. Am I done?
Yeah, your purpose is
over. Of course I'm not done. My purpose is over.
I'm cashed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but an outcome should reflect like approximate objective, progress right. along your purpose.
So
what would be what was your revised purpose?
So my revised purpose was to shift the understanding about innovation so that we can unlock the full potential in humans through the power of innovation.
Right.
So that may be clunky in terms of language, but the point being that the real purpose of why I do what I do is to shift the wrong narrative that's out there, right. The myths that are out there about innovation being for the select few and select right. types, all that, to shift that understanding to be that it really was something we all have, and to unlock all of our full potential through the power of innovation.
Exactly.
That's ultimately why, that's what gets me up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Happily,
that's
right? Nice. So I'm not always happily, most of the times. And you made a good point that the unleashing 1 million everyday innovators is the outward communication of that purpose.
Right.
That's all.
Right.
I don't have to lose that.
Right.
It has a different need than I was thinking of it.
Yeah, it's an objective.
I thought it was a big shift.
Yeah, it's an objective, right?
It
crystallizes and puts some real feedback mechanisms there on your purpose. But
yeah.
And I would even say, knowing you, I would put massively impact humanity,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, that is what I've been thinking about.
Well, you're a man, to change the world, that's too generic, but massively impact. Right, through mindset shifts and through real tools to empower people to make real, to use innovative thinking to make massive change in their life, or major change. Right? I like to use the word massive all the time.
I think. Yeah.
But it's all about significance, and it's got to speak to the core. And purpose is incredibly important because it is the ultimate driver, right? But then we have to turn that into something that is objective-based and has real strategy to get there.
And what I love about that, about unleashing full potential through the power of innovation, is it also makes it clear what lane I want right. to play in and right. do play in, right?
Yep.
It's not unleash full potential,
right.
hard stop, because
right.
what does that even mean, right?
Like, Tony Robbins got that one locked up anyway.
Right, right. Like, what?
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring that up because that does impact, your purpose does impact all of that. And it's important to understand that before you start getting into it. And if you're in an organization or you're in a team who doesn't understand your purpose, you kind of need to back up and say, okay, well, why are we doing what we're doing?
Right.
And what drives us to do this? Because it matters. And, whether it's Simon Sinek or any of those other kind of, quirky people out there, they'll all tell you the why matters. Like, we know that, right? So I just wanted to bring that up. But let's go through this for me. So the key issues and then the strategy. And again, I kind of want to pull apart the strategy. I like to battle test my own stuff.
Let's do it.
So part of me wonders if this makes sense. And for all of us listening, this is Launch Street strategy for growth. This is not about your human potential as the everyday innovator. That's a part of what we, that's why and the part right. of what we're doing. this is how do I get to that massive impact that I want to have. That's what our strategy for 2020 is all about. And again, to our point about you can't look 5 years, this is our 2020.
Right.
And then we'll talk about what some proximate objectives or some milestones might look like to say if we're even headed in that direction, right?
So, okay. Isn't innovative by definition changing? I mean, the core of the most dynamic place in the world.
Well, it's, I mean, the beauty of, I feel really fortunate because the beauty of what we get to do in our at Law Street is we get to help people harness change and realize that it's actually an asset that they can leverage. And all so many of us, I think, feel like change is being pushed on us and it's making us feel irrelevant. But if we can shift our mindset and have some ways to make change our friend, like it's, the opportunities are incredible. So that's a lot of what I get to do. So it's, I mean, I like it for that reason alone, but okay. So for key issues, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and now a fifth, because there's one that we forgot for both of us.
Right.
So one is Law Street and our assessment, right? The innovation quotient edge, which is what tells people their everyday innovator style. It's unique to all of us, how we, you know, our different ways of innovating. We're not well known enough. Like we're known, we have traction, but really to make that massive impact, the reality is we're not nearly where we should be.
Right.
And that is a company issue of like marketing. So we have been doing the IQE in particular for about 2 to 3 years. We have tens of thousands of people that have taken it, but millions should know about what we do and they should get the value out of it. And we're not there.
So Law Street, not well known, and also the IQE is a subset of that is not.
Right. And that's our flagship, right? That's our differentiator. So that in particular is not well known enough.
And how do you define the IQE again?
Innovation quotient. What do you mean? How do I?
Yeah, can you just tell me what that is again?
Oh yeah. So it's an assessment that tells you your unique style of innovation so that you can perform at your peak, ignite more innovative ideas, have a stronger, more valued voice. So there are 9 ways that we as humans innovate. And it's the combination of top 2 power triggers and 1 dormant trigger that make your specific style. So when you understand that, you can actually get to that like state of flow that we always talk about more often. You perform better, you work smarter, not harder. All those things come out of leveraging innovation.
So can I just tie the thread?
Yeah.
You can read like there can be a checklist.
I'm sweating, by the way.
I know. So yeah, but there's these checklists on how to be innovative. What you do that is literally in line with what we talk about. The IQ is a diagnosis of you, so that you can then create a real diagnosed base understanding of how to innovate. So it isn't this blind apply, here's innovative thinking, here's how you do it, here's how Steve Jobs did it. You are diagnosing their particular orientation, tendencies, and thinking patterns so that you can, that is a real, you're starting from the place of actual understanding. They have self-understanding to then map how to use innovative thinking.
That's a great connection. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. The IQ is the diagnosis. Hey, Derek, here's how you innovate. Here's how I innovate, right? And now that you know that about yourself, you can actually put it into action. Totally. Right. Exactly. And that actually leads to my second key issue, which is the narrative in the marketplace and the thing that a lot of our competition is promoting, which is inaccurate, is that innovation is for the select few, select time, select tasks. So like I was listening to a podcast on the way up here and I was going crazy because she's like, I spend Wednesdays on creative tasks. And I, like, it's recorded, so I can't call in, but I want to be caller on line one telling you that that's horseshit.
Right.
Because innovation is something that can happen all the time, right? And this narrative that innovation is for the select few. So all these thought leaders out there talking about, like, be like Steve Jobs, right? Or be like Google or whatever.
So fundamental misunderstanding of what innovation is in the marketplace, in the in everybody.
And it makes it this very rarefied air that, like, you know, oh, look, the innovative person or company is here and they're different. Right. And so, as I've said, you know, many times, like if you think about our purpose, right, it's all about innovation being universal, which neuroscience shows us all of us have the wiring for innovation in our brains. And it's actually that wiring is actually different than with the wiring for intelligence. So we all have it and they're not, there's a baseline you have to have, but they're not, you don't have to be super wicked smart to actually be innovative. They're not the same. So that's the issue though, right? Kind of to your point, your world and mine, it's like there's all these people spewing this narrative and I'm over here trying to fight the good fight. I'm like, no, it's not true. So that's the second one. The third one is, this is both an internal and external key issue, is that it's full of friction. And what I mean by that is There's a lot of barriers to entry. So that narrative creates friction overall, right? Like, it's not for me. It's super hard. It's complex. I got to change how I'm doing stuff. What I also discovered in my company is that there were places in the buying process that have, or in the experience, I should say experience, that's really what I mean, is that there's places of friction that are making it harder to engage than should be.
And you're not allowed, I just want to share a quick fact on that.
Yeah.
Friction, there's in the world, $4 trillion of items in shopping carts not checked out. And Amazon's like, it's almost none. So friction is this huge range, $4 trillion because of friction.
And that friction can be something as one too many clicks to get to buy. It could be something as unclear messaging to get to it, right?
And Amazon systematically, permanently logged in, one click, subscribe and save. Not even have to buy, it just shows up. So friction within engaging, friction within the marketplace, but then friction within how they engage with you and buy your services.
Yes. So there's friction in the marketplace, right? And then there's friction for us. And we had to recognize both.
It's a key issue for sure.
Yeah. The next two are similar to yours. So one is black magic. I'll share a story around it. I used to be in the new product development consulting world, right? So companies like Procter & Gamble, General Mills, IBM, like all these companies hire us, pay us well into the six figures to come up with their next line of products. We would go do our thing. It's this like magical thing that happens behind the curtain. And then we come back and we're like, ta-da. And so no matter how collaborative we were, that innovation was happening behind a curtain. And that is often what happens in the business in general, sure. Innovation. And our goal is to totally transform that and make it tangible and real and easy. But that's the reality that we face. Okay. The next one, which is similar to yours, is systematizing it so that I can scale it. Because unless I can make it easy. I don't know if it's systematized right. I might be making it like just simple.
Right.
Maybe it's simplicity. I got to think about that one for a minute.
The key issue is that, so the idea is to deliver more value at a larger scale is bottlenecked.
Scaling is bottlenecked.
Right. And because, so the key issue within that though is there is a bottleneck to scale, and that is you. How would you hone that key issue?
Lack of systems.
Okay. There you go. So,
and systems can be anything from
or
even proper use of systems. We have some brilliant CRM systems, but do we use it to the max? No. We have Basecamp. We love Basecamp, but are we using it to the fullest to make it so that we can scale? No. And so that's what I would say. Okay. That's actually the issue. Okay. So those are the issues. So not well known enough. The kind of false narrative in the marketplace. Full of friction internally and externally, black magic, and bottlenecks that are keeping us from system, bottlenecks that are keeping us from scaling. So those are the key issues.
Got it.
That leads to the strategy that we mapped out. And again, I want to poke holes in this because now I feel like, is it right? Is it not right? So we're just going to do this live on air instead of keeping it
secret. Let's do this.
Yeah. So a frictionless one-to-many innovation experience. So let me tell you why I like it. And then I do want to poke holes. And by the way, I'm one of those people in innovation who thinks yes and is overrated. I think sometimes you just need to figure out what you missed.
Right.
So frictionless, meaning.
Love platitude.
Totally. Yes and. I'm like, oh God. Thank you. I feel so heard. you need diversity of thinking, right?
Right.
So frictionless being about making it. All our stuff is about making it easy and tangible and personal and real for people.
Right.
I mean, that's why we have an assessment. So you, the everyday person, can see that you do innovate, right?
Right.
But we want to make the entire journey frictionless for people from engaging with us to using our tools to implementing the tools, right?
So within this, the operating policy or the principle of methodology section, one is a global one that can inform many actions be, reduce friction.
Yes.
And that solves, how they engage and buy from you, but also that addresses your system and scaling issue. Like you want to reduce friction internal and external, right? That is a focus area that will inform the action plan which comes next. and something you can keep coming back to as you review and check in and you know, move towards your objectives, right? And so, you know, prioritize reduction in friction, right? Yeah. So where are the top spots of friction, and then a plan to reduce those, so that focus area, right?
Frictionless.
Internal and external friction.
Right. And to your point, like, it's also like, how do me and my team engage with each other, making that frictionless so that we can do our best work. And then with the world, how do we make it so easy for them to engage with us that they get the power of innovation?
Yep.
How do we make it so simple for them? And that's on the website, in the phone system, in our Basecamp, how we use Basecamp, like, it's all in it, right?
And using pictures, not words, to express certain aspects of what you do. So it's easy to grasp.
Exactly.
Friction.
Right? Exactly. So one-to-many innovation experience, the reason we have that.
So this is the second principle.
Yes.
Okay.
The reason we have that, right, is we are deeply entrenched in a very wonderful way in the community that we're in. But what we need to get to that massive impact and to deal with that key issue of not well known and shifting the narrative is we need to grow, right?
Right.
We need to grow a ton. So what I want is for what I think is our principle is a one-to-many, I don't know if innovation is right there, a one-to-many strategy, meaning like it's not just about one-to-one, but how do we get to the gatekeeper that has another 10,000 people we can impact?
Right. Okay. Right. So one-to-many. So it's like acquiring acquiring people who have access to many. So one yes equals many, right? So the idea here is to be very targeted with who you engage. Is that
not just who, it's also where and how. So
okay.
I'll give you several examples. So one is, you know, we have a book coming out in May. That's a one-to-many product.
Right.
Right? So one of the things I was thinking about on the way up here is a deck of cards that like you could pull an exercise or pull a card for innovation, or like maybe there's different sections of it, but that's a one-to-many product.
I got you.
Right? So in our PR, in our marketing, someone called me just the other day to do a webcast for them. They have 50,000 people in their database.
Right.
It's in a space that we can make a positive impact, so it has to be a good fit. But that's something I accepted. Because to me, that's a friction. If I can deliver it in a frictionless way, it's a one-to-many innovation experience.
Right. Right. So, okay. Yeah. I see what you're saying, right? I was thinking like a second principle would be, you know, shift the marketplace understanding through high impact activities like, you know, you do keynotes, your book. What are ways to open, right? So I think that's what you're saying by one to many.
Yeah.
But the idea is like a grouping of things, like part of your key issues is people fundamentally think about this wrong and they're unaware of you both. So the idea, the principle would be, you know, identify and execute high areas of impact that change how people think about innovation in the process that also handles bringing you to their awareness. So that would, under that would be all the podcasts, appearances, your book. These are all ways to establish a fundamental shift in how people think about innovation, as well as establish you as the leader, right?
Okay, I was just writing as you were talking. What if the strategy is this? So again, to go back to just for all of us listening, right? This is about how do you create a strategy that actually allows you to drive the right tactics.
That's
and,
right.
And
addresses all the key.
And that's why we're going round and round, because there's a lot of like, oh yeah, well that sounds good, but it doesn't really.
Right.
So what if it's
And the other reason this tomorrow is like, people want to see the key issues and they want to jump right into an action plan.
Right.
What you need is a principle thinking between that allows iteration through the action plan. And that's why this step is super important. So.
Okay, this may or may not be right, but go with it. Shift the human narrative through.
Did you just tell me not to give an opinion, but go with it? No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
I would never do that.
Yeah, right. Is that a question?
Shift in the human narrative through a frictionless high value experience.
Yeah.
So that's the strategy.
Right.
Because what that tells me is shifting the human narrative is how do I get to like more and more people, right? So that has the same impact on our marketing strategy or marketing tactics that I was just kind of talking about with the one-to-many. This means that we're very, the human narrative means that we're very clear in our communication about our belief and our like where we stand. Frictionless is what we were just talking about, like removing that friction from engaging with us, from buying with us, from our messaging. And then the high value speaks to, I don't know if I need that in there. That was just me wanting to always deliver high value. Maybe I didn't need that.
No, I mean, I think that the high value experience this will help you choose which actions, and high value is a checkpoint. So I don't think as long as that's meaningful to you.
Well, it's meaningful to me because I think a lot of the stuff out there
you could do isn't high value.
Yeah.
It's middling.
Right. So now what I think about, so this feels a lot better than frictionless one to many.
Right.
Because, so shifting human narrative on innovation means also that the places I should be focusing on my time are for putting content out into the world.
Right.
So whether that's our 10-minute version of innovation, the podcast, articles that I write, interviews that I do, right? So this means that, like, one of our marketing strategies is to be ubiquitous in the marketplace, which who doesn't want that? But our point being that means that I have to take every opportunity to be out there in the world talking about this.
Right.
So that tactic becomes real based on this strategy. Yeah.
Where you can make a high impact and deliver high value, right? Not just everywhere.
Right.
Because this will hone and focus where you're going to show up.
Right. So through that frictionless experience, high value experience, frictionless also, in my opinion, it's two things. One is that kind of tangible friction you and I were talking about like the one click versus the two click and all that. But that's also the friction that's created by the false narrative of like, it's only for the select few. So this is going to be super hard. And like, it forces me to make sure everything is real and easy and simple.
Right. Right. From your explanation of it, of what innovation is, all the way to engaging with you.
Right. Exactly. So everything should be frictionless with us. And it's funny. So this is a little bit of a side note, but it relates to frictionless. A colleague and I were talking about this. One of the things that clients continually say back to both of us, keynote clients, when we're hired to speak, is, oh my God, you're so easy to work with. And we have a couple of colleagues who, that is not the feedback you get from them.
That's right.
Right? From clients. It's always like, God, she was so high maintenance or like kind of meaty or just like really hard to work with. And my friend Kelly and I have always contended that part of the reason we get hired back continually is because clients are like, oh my God, she's so easy to work with. Like, we'll just hire her. She gets her own water. Like, that sounds silly, but like those little things all add up.
No red M&Ms or whatever.
Right, yeah, brown M&Ms. Was it brown? Sorry.
Yeah.
So let me just pull it all together because now I want to talk about what those proximate objectives would look like. So the issues, not well known, the false narrative, full of friction, black magic, and the bottlenecking to scale.
Right.
The strategy is shift the human narrative on innovation through a frictionless high value experience. So that actually makes a lot more sense given, I think it's actually great because now we've seen what a like bad strategy is, a mediocre one, and now we've gotten to a good strategy. Let's talk about proximate objectives because now this leads me to the next part, which is how do I know if I'm headed in the right direction?
Right. And we have your highest level objective is the unleash 1 million everyday
innovators,
correct? Okay.
Yeah, because so the thing that I love about that is I know that at 1 million, we shift the narrative.
Well, it's tipping point, right? I mean,
that's why that 1 million matters to me.
Right.
So to me, that means how many, and the way we gauge that, because it's the most tangible way we can do it, is how many people take the IQE.
Okay.
The assessment, because I could say, well, how many people like your Facebook page or whatever, but all that is just fluff, in my opinion.
Well, and we go back to properly, like, to really unleash a million innovators, they have to know themselves, which is a diagnosis, in order to actually consistently innovate.
It's step one.
They need to know what they're working with.
Right, exactly.
Themselves.
Exactly. So one of our proximate objectives, or one of our milestones, however you want to call it, is how many people are taking the assessment.
Right.
And that tells us if we're growing or not growing, if we're headed in the right direction, and if it's frictionless, because if it's full of friction, people won't. If it's not full of friction, people will. So and we have done a lot of work in the last year to remove friction, and we've seen a drastic increase because the friction has gone away.
Right.
It's that friction. Anyway, there's more to deal with.
Right.
So that's one, is the people taking the IQE.
Right.
I think another one for us is...
And a good proximate objective could be something around, how targeting a percentage of people who engage with the IQE and then purchase it. So in other words,
Yeah,
in other words, say How many people, what is the people who take the full IQ and then target within there? All right, you know, 50% make it, I would like it to be at 80% because that implies a significant reduction in friction.
And it means we're changing the narrative because people are buying in.
Right. Well, right, they're buying in and, but then on the other side, how many people get to the first step, engaging with the IQ, period, but then how many of those convert? So you have two great proximate objectives. One is I want to triple the traffic.
Right. People coming to actually get to even
visualize to engage
it.
With the IQ as an offer. And then the other is I would like to move from 25% to 50 or something significant.
Right.
So you have two highly specific close range objectives that show that you are marching along this pathway, both towards the objective and within your strategy, right?
So, I mean, to be honest, couldn't I just stick to those two? I mean, one of the things that he said in the book that so my simplification overcomes inertia.
That was
something he said in Good Strategy, Bad Strategy that I wrote down and circled and starred because inertia is our biggest enemy, I think, in all of this, in life, actually, frankly.
Totally.
And I think like there's a part of me that wants to make this 30 different fucking objectives. So, but that's not helpful. Right. Those two things may be enough. And I think that's a great insight for all of us trying to build a smart strategy and some objectives or some milestones or approximate objectives around it is simplification is key.
Right. Two things done completely is better than 10 half.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
In a military example, I don't think he uses it, but I use it all the time. If you have enemies on three hills and you have 10 guys, you don't send, you know, three to each. You send 10 to the first, you take that hill, then whoever's left over, and you're down to seven. But no matter what, that prioritization gives you the best chance to take it.
Right. And here's the other cool thing about what we just did, Derek, is so a number of people that take the IQ either do the free, because we have a free level on our site. That's important. Right. People get a piece of the diagnosis of themselves, but not the whole thing.
Right.
Then the number that pay, right? So, here's what's awesome about those. What that forces me to do is not spend time on the other things that don't drive those two objectives.
Right.
And that's the hard part for people like me.
Right.
So like, I will give you a great example. This just happened because you know, Laura really well, who's my business manager and she's phenomenal. She's, I'm a visionary. She's an integrator, which comes from Rocket Fuel.
Right.
So we can talk, we should wrap a little bit up about that too when we talk about it. I wanted to make these changes to the toolkit part of it, the online library, which I love it. It's awesome. But I wanted to go down a rabbit hole.
Right.
And she said, well, how does that help us get to more people taking the assessment?
That's great.
And I was like, shut up, Laura.
Yeah.
But she's right. I said, you know, she goes, why don't we put that on? She goes, you're right. We need to do that. But why don't we put that on the back burner?
Right.
And like, once we hit this, then we'll go back and do that. So glad you're thinking about it tomorrow, but we're not doing it right now. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. That doesn't, like, this tells me this, I'm pointing at the number taking the IQ and the percent purchase. This tells me exactly what I should and should not be working on.
Right, prioritization.
Across the business.
Right, exactly. Prioritization so you can get concentrated effort to really move the needle, but you know it's high impact area based on your strategy.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you know you can relax because you're obviously brilliant. One of the most brilliant people I've met. You can supply more ideas than anyone can do.
Right.
Which is your downfall, but you can't convince yourself, just concentrate here. But if you have a structured method that allows you to concentrate, you can then focus in because you know you have looked at the big picture and drilled down to highest impact. This is the only way I've seen to do that consistently.
Right, which is why this book was such a great, I think, springboard for this conversation. And I'll here's the other thing I'd just say for the innovative mind, for all of us, it doesn't mean that you stop thinking about the other things. What I do think is important is that you track those things, right? So I have a document on Basecamp that has all the like things that I want to get to.
Right.
Because what you don't want to do is shut down the brain to the place where you're not thinking about those things because they matter, but they're just not your focus right now.
You got to quarantine them, but don't forget about them.
You'll want to go back to them because when that changes, that's the thing about it all being dynamic, right? And our point about trends. At some point, this changes. When we get to the really great place that we want to get to with that, we can then shift it to, I would envision our next strategy being about behavior change
Right.
And because that's, I mean, it's inherent in shifting the narrative,
which would be
the toolkit, not the assessment, but assessment is number one because that's the diagnosis. Right.
And that's the thing, a good strategy evolves the action plan. Like you may shift the strategy based on new key issues, but the action plan fits within this, but it's a rolling thing based on sound thinking.
Right. Exactly. So
this is and I wonder, this you just brought up an important point.
Yeah.
Key issues, as we did it a little bit, is not just about the problems, it is equally about the opportunities. So how we do it,
right.
Our clients have a million ideas too. So we capture in the full diagnosis, there's always like opportunities to evaluate that we find. And we have to periodically go through those, sift those and see when to incorporate them. But the strategy is the filter. So those things have to go up against this. They could be great. And you probably have ideas for a dozen different businesses. Capture them, hold them, but then let this be the filter so that you can prioritize and actually get the key things done.
Well, it's funny. So, you know, I was mentioning earlier that I had this idea for this deck of cards, right? So I took some notes while I was in my car before I came in. And in my head, I was like, I should do this right away. But as we're working through this, what it made me realize is no. Actually, that's not the first thing I need to be doing. It's all this, and then I can get to that. But
right. But
it's a great filter. And I think, you know, when we work with clients on innovation, so we'll often do things where they'll hire us to do these kind of continual workshops, right, where they leverage, let me say this differently. We understand how everybody in the room innovates because then we can build exercises that actually unlock that in them. And then we can apply that towards real world challenges and opportunities. And so like we'll do one a month with a client, right? So I wouldn't call it a retainer. I'd call it a long-term innovation program for them. And it kind of is like double benefit because on one hand, we're helping them solve challenges. And on the other hand, we're training them on how to think in an innovative way across everything they do in the times that we're not together, right?
Right.
So, but what I love about it, how it relates to this part is there are a million things that get written down on those easel pads that are not right for now, but they're kept.
Right.
Because at some point, we're going to want to revisit those things.
Right.
And quantity over quality to start. So this is a little bit of a side note, but I was reading, I can't remember. I've read so many books at once. I can't remember where this one came from. But basically, there was a study done. I think it was a photography professor. For half the class, he said, your grade's on quantity. For the other half, he said, your grade's on quality. Like, right. You need to deliver top-notch photos. And to this other group, it's like, you just need to deliver quantity, a lot of them.
Right.
What he found at the end, to no surprise, was that those that were in the quantity group had way better photographs. Their quality was actually better because they were out there thinking, experimenting, trying, and they weren't worried about that one right photo.
That's right.
The people in the other group were.
That's right.
So quantity in our world matters, right? Tracking those ideas. And in digital marketing, I think it's true because an idea that I have today may not be right for our objectives, but it may be right later.
That's right.
So that was a little bit of a tangent, but I thought that was a fascinating study.
It might be out of grant. And like, that's what's funny because they study famous artists similarly. And the output of Da Vinci, Picasso is literally 4 or 5x everybody else.
Right.
They didn't have a per art higher hit ratio. They just had more
of it. Yeah.
Now, again, though, that can be part of any strategy, right? So how do you deal with all that output? It still has to be structured in the approach, and it could be quarantining for later, periodically
revisiting
it. But in some cases, sheer output can work, right?
Right. So to wrap this up, and I do want to talk a little bit about visionary integrator, because you kind of hinted at it. So for mine, you've got your key issues. I've kind of gone through those. You've got your strategy, which is now shift the human narrative on innovation through a frictionless high value experience. Love that. And the proximate objectives that we're going to gauge on whether we're hitting it is number of people who take the IQE for free. So basically people kind of come into our world and then percent of purchase from that, like people that then go that one level to get the full picture of themselves. And that's so simple.
That's right. I'm done.
Like, I want to say more, but that's it.
That's it. And all actions that spring from this are focused there.
Right. I mean, we don't have time to go into all the tactics, but this.
You have a guiding light now.
Right. This, and for you too, about the transformative employee and client experience, this determines how we do our marketing, our sales, our operations, our fill in the blank, right?
And that's
the part that makes this strategy so awesome,
right,
I think.
Exactly. And having our focus, you know, we train on how to communicate. We are constantly improving the visuals we use, and then we check for understanding. So that the fundamental, the cascade effect of the right strategy is all the actions compound over time because they're a long and thoughtful approach. And so, and that shift is important because of how compounding works, right?
Right,
so,
right. What is it that Einstein said? Compounding interest.
Is the most powerful force in the universe.
The eighth wonder of the, right? What do you say? The eighth, I'm going to botch the quote.
I read a couple of jokes, but Einstein gets all the...
No, I'm not sure to say, but it, basically, he who understands it earns it, and he who doesn't pays.
That's right.
Something like that,
right? Right.
But I think that's true for innovation, too, like the compounding value. But to your point, that's true in strategy, too.
That's right.
Well, this has been amazing. Let's wrap up by talking a little bit about rocket fuel, because it was like subtly integrated into part of the conversation, but we really focused on good strategy, bad strategy for good reason. And rocket fuel, so the tagline, the subtitle is the one essential combination that will get you more of what you want from your business. And I think this might've been one that you gifted me early on. So, and it talks about visionaries versus integrators and this idea that you need both in your business. And I think both of us took the assessment and obviously we're off the charts on the visionary side. So, and the thing for people I'd say that about visionaries is that we're like untethered balloons. Seriously, right? Like we're just like, if there isn't someone with a hold on that balloon to help make it useful and real and relatable, we tend to float away.
Right.
Not in a bad way, just we're full of like, we're full of the future.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, where integrators are people who can take that idea and implement it, turn it into something, communicate it to other people.
Right.
And it kind of reminded me of Derek Sivers, TED Talks, like one of those 3-minute ones about the first follower.
Right.
And have you seen that one? It's one of my favorites.
Great.
So hopefully we'll have a link in the show notes.
The one guy crazy dancing and then the next one.
Yeah, it's like a Grateful Dead looking concert.
Yeah,
and one guy's dancing all by himself and he looks absolutely crazy. And it wasn't until the first follower came and danced with him and then got everybody else. And then suddenly everybody on that field was dancing with this lone crazy guy, right? Who was no longer alone. So I think this idea of like you need the different types of people is really powerful, and understanding how you work together to build something stronger versus just the friction that they can be created by working with people who are not like you.
I would say, and so having read an egregious amount of books on how to do businesses, right? Having had 12 companies, this is the first one that started with an assessment, right?
And the diagnosis,
and
yet again.
Diagnosis, it diagnosed correctly and had a preset strategy for a lower percentage type of entrepreneur. And visionaries always need integrators, but integrators, which are the majority of business owners, do not need visionaries. Integrators are good business operators. If you move into like a auto mechanic place, let's say, like you have a standard offering that doesn't really need creative vision, right? Doesn't need someone pushing the edge of what's possible. They do phenomenal. And so integrators are self-sufficient, but a visionary without that well-balanced
individual,
we're untethered balloons, right?
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that is interesting though, is visionaries are often the most celebrated business owners, like Richard Branson, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk.
Always.
So these guys get, in the press, it seems like there's more of them, but they have entire companies that help manage their crazy side.
Well, and right? Actually, if you look at all of those examples, if you actually pull back the layer beyond the cover of the magazine, they have integrators in lockstep with them. They're not it's not just
every
the employees.
Sometimes multiple.
Right. So, that understanding of having the two types of people, one who can kind of see, take you to the future, and one who can take that and translate it into real world and tactics and make sure you're staying on track, I think is essential to growth.
Right. Well, and this is for visionaries. This is where actually this proves the point of a proper diagnosis informs the strategy and the action plan. Because without that distinction, I read the book E-Myth and I was like, this is brilliant. They're all integrators who gave me the E-Myth. It's logical on how they apply.
It's all about systems.
It's all about systems. When I read this one, this is the first one who's like, oh, you will never be good at that. Like you're at QE.
Yeah.
Listen, like if you don't understand your pre-built tendencies,
you're not going to be good at that.
You can't follow a checklist without understanding what you are and how you operate. So this, I made my entire company read The first chapter describes what is a visionary. And so, you know, they set it down. They go, oh, you make so much more sense now.
Right. And now they know
sometimes.
Now they know how to leverage you better.
Right.
And you know how to, I don't want to say temper, but like build a communication or a relationship approach that works for them too. Because here's my other issue sometimes, and this one doesn't do it as much, but well, maybe a little bit. Sometimes I feel like there was another personality assessment I took that was like, you're either an inventor, a performer, a producer, or a judge.
Yeah, right.
So inventors are often La La Land. Performers are very like the charismatic salesperson. The producer's the person who does stuff, and the judge is the yes but person, just to sum it up. What annoyed me about the training behind it was that I felt I'm an inventor, but it gave all of us inventors permission to be assholes.
That's
and
right.
I wasn't okay with that.
Right.
It gave performers, they're always late, by the way, performers have no sense of time. So it gave them permission to be like, oh, I'm always late and like right. I never remember anything because I'm a performer and I'm too in the moment. And it gave producers too much permission to be in the weed and not be responsible for trying to think big picture.
Right.
And judges, they got to be all jerky and analytical at all the wrong times because right. they're judges.
Right.
And I'm not okay with that because right. I do think you have to understand how to communicate with people who are not like you, and that responsibility is on you and the other person.
Totally agree. And but from the space of, so here's the thing, oh, you need better systems, go do it. It's different than you're wired to go this way. And
right.
here is a system built for people like you to help facilitate that. So,
right.
you know, and it, so
that
it wasn't just like
that
a good entrepreneur does this, the good to great thing. A good company does these 20 things. Well, that is useless.
True, but actually,
it's useless and worse, it's misleading. You
right.
think if you jump into this big checklist. So where they do a pretty good job is they frame it good, but they don't shy away from some of the bad sides of the visionary.
Right.
The organizational whiplash is my biggest problem. Like I
yes.
have ideas a minute,
I
but my team
people.
Takes it as marching orders.
Yeah.
So, but
and
how,
you're like, I don't know, I just said it out loud.
Right, exactly.
And,
I was just thinking. Right?
And just to, for the organizational whiplash, not only that, but when we do force it, because we do sometimes force like the paths that we're on.
Right.
The whiplash, we are not cognizant of the whiplash or the initiative fatigue that
right.
it creates on the other side.
Right.
And it can create our need to like constantly adapt and change.
Right.
Can create chaos.
That's right. And what the big threat to having team members is engagement, right? 72%
yeah.
of the workforce in America is actively disengaged.
Yeah.
If you're whiplashing all around, that destroys engagement, even if you have a great purpose.
Yeah.
So
that's our challenge. So I agree with you. Like I like that it went into that because I really struggle with books that give you permission to be the caricature
right. yep.
of your personality and not have responsibility for how you engage with others.
Right.
I want to go back really quickly to what you were talking about, E-Myth.
Right.
So here was the thing about that book. So I read it as part of this business program I was in, and they held it up as like the icon of how we should be thinking about our businesses.
Right.
And at the time, I remember really struggling with it because there was a part of my business at that point in particular that wasn't ready for making every French fry the same French fry,
right.
you know?
Right.
And it felt like it was forcing me into a systems place that my business wasn't ready for, because frankly, I wasn't sure which system was the right system because I was still figuring it all out. So I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up because I don't know if I read it now, if I'd feel totally different because I'm in a different place. I haven't.
Well, so here's the thing, right? It is a blind prescription, not based on an actual diagnosis. In fact, because of what
you
just...
all goes back to lack of diagnosis.
To me, it's the number one mistake people make in purse, from dating
yeah.
to business, to how to handle
kids. Every one of our... We're going to have all my dating as
yeah.
part of our
yeah,
conversation.
Right. You know, what is it? G.I. Joe says, knowing is half the battle. But I would articulate that differently. Like a proper diagnosis gets you most of the way to the solution because now you know where to concentrate. But one of your key issues was you don't have systems. Now we talked about this
right,
at the beginning. You're reading with the intent to learn against specific identified challenges. E-Myth may be more valuable now.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I haven't read it. I just remember at that point thinking, I can't achieve this. This is like
the other thing the myth does not do is prioritize what, how to. My question is, I'll just do all of this halfway and get no better. Well, how do you prioritize the process? And here's the problem.
Right.
If you don't, it's a customized diagnosis. There is no formula other than evaluate, figure out, and implement.
Right.
And so you can't just checklist your way through that.
So
other than at the broadest level.
So my takeaway from this conversation is, proper diagnosis is fundamental to anything that you do.
Sure.
And probably the thing that we miss the most. And your strategy needs to be something you can actually implement against and not a platitude, which you and I both knew going into this conversation. But I don't know until, like, I have believed in diagnosis being important, but I think until this conversation, I don't think I really wrap my head around how it translates into everything else that we do.
It is the starting point that allows for action to be effective.
Yeah. So this has been amazing. And I hope that for listeners out there, they really start to think, first of all, pick up the books, but also pick up some of these books, not some of the other books.
Right.
And also think about that how you're doing proper diagnosis, make sure you're doing that, and creating the proper strategy. And I think the cool thing about strategy is, as we've talked about it today and has outlined kind of where we're pulling from, is that it can be at the team level too. So you can own a company and do strategy, of course, but you could do it at a brand level, like if you manage a business or a brand inside a company, or at the team level and you manage a team. Like, it doesn't have to be just for the owner of the company
100%.
On down, or the CEO on 100%. Down. You know, I think it's at all levels you want to think about the strategy, which makes me think I'm going to do one for my personal life. See how that goes. In general.
Well, and if you diagnose your personal life interwoven with business, you can start to really get effective areas to focus on. Right. So I don't believe in the work-life balance. I'm not sure what that even means. But what I would say is full integration is a thoughtful diagnosis of, you know, where do you want to go, but then what are the key issues that run up? And people don't, just articulating them will create aha moments.
Yeah.
And now you have the right assembles of targets to go after. So I agree.
I love it.
We can do that one next. You can be vulnerable and share all the personal things going on, right? And we'll see how that
goes. Here are my key issues, personally. I don't ask questions.
Your questions are deliberative statements.
Yeah, that's it. That's right.
Declarative.
I do ask questions. They just come out declarative.
No one knows it.
I know. All right. Well, I'm going to click off now in terms of record, but we definitely have to decide what we want to talk about next, because this has been fantastic.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.